Probably did.
Morning, Council.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Kane, and I represent the appellant Richard T. Ford in this appeal of Judge Robertson's decision entering judgment in favor of the Navy against Mr. Ford following a bench trial on Mr. Ford's federal sector age discrimination case. As we point out in our brief, the trial court judge applied the wrong law to Mr. Ford's case. The correct law, 633A, states that all personnel actions shall be free from any discrimination based on age.
Don't you think that was just a typo?
Well, I think it's more than a typo. We look at Gomez-Perez, the Supreme Court case and the Foreman case, and they are pretty clear that the federal sector case is different than the private sector case.
Right.
So they demand, the federal sector case demands a different analysis, and I think that's particularly true in light of the Gross decision.
Are you now talking about the Price Waterhouse issue? And
yeah. I am talking about the Price Waterhouse issue.
Gotcha. That is what the case is okay. The Price Waterhouse issue.
I think that's right.
As I read the district court's decision, the district court was prepared to apply Price Waterhouse, but concluded, I think, that there wasn't sufficient evidence to shift the burden. Right? Isn't that what he said?
Well, I don't know. From the bench, Judge Robertson used words like infected, infused, right. Played a part. In the post-trial brief, the Navy said that age likely played a role. So we think under the free from any language, that was sufficient to shift the burden of proof to the Navy to discount age as a reason for the decision. We think that the judge, in applying the mixed motive, held Mr. Ford to too high a standard. He used the word substantial in his...
So that's what you meant when you said applied the wrong legals. You weren't talking about... I see. Okay. I understand.
When he says a substantial, it seems to me that what he's really asking is, or demanding from Mr. Ford, is a determining factor, even though Mr. Ford has already shown that age infected the process. And under the federal sector law, free from any, really should be interpreted as, if the plaintiff can show that age played a role, the burden should shift to the government in that situation to prove that it was not, in fact, a determining factor.
And tell me specifically which are the district court findings that you think are sufficient to do that?
Well, from the judge's comments from the bench, he found that age infected the process, infused the process. In his written opinion, he said that I acknowledge that the Navy monitored the aging of its workforce or the ages of its workforce. That the 20-year age difference between Mr. Ford and Mr. Johnson was a factor in their decision-making. So those findings justify flipping the burden or shifting the burden to the Navy to show that age wasn't the determining factor. To do otherwise is to hold Mr. Ford to really proving quantity, to proving just how much age was a factor, which is really not fair to him under the free from any language. And
what? Let's assume you're right that that number one, because of the broader language of 633, that the burden shifting mechanism applies, and assume you're right also that the district court's findings are sufficient to do that. What are the consequences to the Navy of meeting that burden? Suppose, as I understand it, under Title VII as amended, it doesn't, satisfying that burden protects the employer from back pay and reinstatement, right?
Yes.
But not, there's still a finding of liability, correct?
Correct.
Now, does that apply here also?
No, I think this is a traditional affirmative defense, such as Price Waterhouse, where if the Navy, first of all, the Navy didn't raise the affirmative defense, but if they had and if they were able to show the affirmative defense, they would escape liability because they would have shown that it wasn't a but-for factor or a determining factor. So it's your traditional.
But if, okay. But you emphasize the language free from discrimination, right?
Well, free from any. I think any is
free from any discrimination. So let's assume that the district court's findings amount to a finding that age was at least one factor, right? So if the employer is able to show that the employer would have taken the same action in any event, does that mean that age was not a factor?
Well, I think age is still a factor. I would argue.
Then is the workplace free from discrimination?
It is not.
Then I'm surprised at your answer to my question.
Well, I would argue that the language is what it is. Free from any means free from any, and it should be held that way, and the government shouldn't be able to escape all liability.
Now, what are the remedial consequences? You shouldn't be able to escape all liability. What are the remedial consequences if the judge made a finding, as he does here, that it was not a but-for cause in the promotion decision? What is the remedy for the discrimination you say was supported by the other evidence?
Well, if we use Title VII as a guide.
Well, we can't. That's what Gross says.
I'm sorry. That's what Gross says. Well, this court, though.
We're just looking at the language of this statute, right? Free from any discrimination based on age. That's our language. So the question that we're both getting at here is, assuming you're right that the burden does shift, what are the consequences to the employer of satisfying the burden? Is it like Title VII, where liability remains but the employer is protected from back pay and reinstatement? Or, as your first answer to my question was, the employer escapes liability, and then I asked you, well, how's that consistent with the statute?
Well, that latter scenario is not consistent with the statute's plain language.
Then your answer to my question is, I take it not, is different.
Well, it is. Pre-Price Waterhouse, this court had an affirmative defense which absolved.
Right, but Title VII, the amendments to Title VII changed that for Title VII, mm-hmm. Right?
Right. But right, it changed it for Title VII, but I was just referring to how this court treated that question prior to Title VII. Certainly, the court has equitable powers, and if it finds that the statute was violated, it could use its equitable powers to provide whatever relief it thought was appropriate.
Would that be here?
Well, what we argued for in the post-trial briefs was in statement to the position, as well as any back pay and any attorney's fees and costs incurred in pursuing the act. The federal sector law doesn't provide for compensatory damages or punitive damages.
Right.
So the remedies are relatively limited, but there should be at least an acknowledgement that a violation of the statute occurred because the free from any language was violated.
Why do you stop at free from any discrimination without saying based on age when Gross says based on age means because of, and if you read that whole phrase, free from any discrimination because of age or whatever the race, gender, that we're back at it has to be the but-for. And this whole discussion of what Judge Robertson said about age was in the air or infused or infected, he did say one thing, and on page 354 and 355 of the joint appendix, and he repeats it in the post-trial brief because he says, He begins by saying, it doesn't strike me as inappropriate, unlawful, or even un-PC, non-PC, for the Navy to take a look at the resources it has and to decide for itself whether those resources are aging, and to decide for itself that it needs to replenish those resources with younger people. I don't see a problem with that. Then he says the problem would be, of course, if in the individual case somebody looked at somebody else and said, well, he doesn't fit the profile, we've got to have a younger guy here. I didn't find any evidence in this case that that was actually done. And well, he reiterates that.
Right. Well, addressing your first question, I think the based on age language in the federal sector is different from the gross language in Title VII, which is an employer shall not fire someone because of their age. Here we have free from any discrimination based on age. I think based on age is circular, just goes right back to free from any. It's saying, it's modifying it. Any, if we look up the definition, it means even a least amount, even a small amount. That's not something that's present in Title VII. So if we really dissect the language here and look at the definitions,
Why doesn't the sentence of Judge Robertson, I didn't find any evidence that that was actually done, any right. evidence?
Well,
why isn't
that's
that free it. From?
He didn't what I take that to mean, okay, if you try to make that consistent with all the language he used about infecting and infusing and played a role, I think what he's talking about there is direct evidence, because that's what he...
I suggest the contrary might be read into it. That sentence that we're all quoting from that says, shall be made free from any discrimination based on age, is the sentence that is 633A sub A, is that correct?
Yes.
The subject of that sentence is all personnel actions shall be made free from any discrimination based on age. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't render it impossible that there could be other discrimination going on in the workplace that did not cause that personnel action to be made based on any discrimination based on age. It's not, those are not necessarily inconsistent. His findings that there was discrimination elsewhere in the workplace is not a finding that this particular transaction was not made free from any discrimination based on age. And it's all personnel actions that have to be made free from any discrimination. The view for which you're opting seems to create the danger that once there has ever been discrimination in the workplace, from then on, all decisions made in that same workplace would be subject to relief. And I can't read the statute as intending that.
Oh, well, I'm not.
If there's discrimination in the air, but it had nothing to do with this personnel action, then that isn't violated, is it?
Well, I'm not suggesting that kind of broad reading. I'm limiting it to the selection of Mr. Ford, and that the judge is finding that the 20-year age difference played a role in the process. And I think that means that Mr. Ford gets liability. I know I'm out of time, but...
Yeah, we have a tendency to talk lawyers all the time here. We're not very careful about our clocks.
If I could just raise 2 points in my direct here, two other issues that Judge Robertson, I believe, made errors on. Be there evidence or just findings of fact. On the missing recommendation memo, I think that was very prejudicial.
But didn't he hold it? Was he holding that against the Navy?
Well, there's no finding of fact or conclusion of law as to what exactly was the negative inference under Rule 15.
Right, but he did say he was doing a negative inference.
He did, but we don't know what that...
It wasn't strong enough to reach the conclusion you wanted, but he's drawn a negative inference.
Well, he said it raised negative inferences in his mind
right.
about what it said, but
right.
but he doesn't actually say what that negative inference was. And I think we need to know exactly what it is that he thinks that memo said.
It's a pretty detailed level of review for us to have over a trial judge counsel, that where he says I'm drawing negative inferences from the withheld document. Why isn't that enough?
Because Mr. Ford's burden here is to show free from any discrimination. He's already shown it's infected, it's infused, that the 20-year age difference played a role. What was the negative inference that Judge Robertson drew that wasn't sufficient to get Mr. Ford over that free from any hurdle? I think we were at a great disadvantage because as plaintiff we were trying to rebut hypothetical, theoretical types of reasons. The real reasons were in that recommendation memo when we never saw it. And one other point as I go over my time, the Bradley reference, we objected to that coming in. And based on relevancy and hearsay. That went a long way to Judge Robertson's decision because he said he actually said that. It goes a long way to explaining the decision.
Yeah, but it's not hearsay, is it? It was not offered for the truth of what was contained in the reference, but rather for the effect of the reference on the decision maker. The court is not saying we're letting this in because we believe the reference was correct about him being whatever it was they said about him.
Right, right. But even if we say it's not hearsay because it went to state of mind, the problem I have with
it's not
it,
hearsay
it
because it's not offered for the truth of the matter contained therein. It's not hearsay because it's not hearsay.
I understand that, Your Honor. But I'm going to the next step, which is the relevancy problem. Judge Robertson relied on that reference to say it went a long way to explaining Mr. Brachofsky's decision. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Brachofsky testified that it had no impact at all on his decision. So that had to be a clearly erroneous finding of fact because of Mr. Brachofsky's testimony.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We did take you over your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Morning. Christian Attiello on behalf of Ray Mabus, Secretary of the Navy. May it please the court. The district court, while citing the wrong statute, I think ultimately got the standard right. 633A, based on gross, requires the same showing that does 623A, which is that age must be the determining factor. Now, there's some discussion by this court in the Cuddy versus Carmen decision, the 1983
decision. Wait, before you go to decisions. Sure. Gross says quite clearly that we're supposed to look at the language of the statute, right?
Yes.
Okay. And 633A is very different from 623A.
True.
And we and the Supreme Court have pointed that out. 633A is a sweeping provision, whereas 623A is much more limited, right? So the argument that the plaintiffs and the amicus make is that, you know, Gross said, look, absent the statute changing the burden of proof, the default rule is it remains with the plaintiff, right? And the court saw no reason to depart from that in the case of the private section. But the plaintiffs and the amicus argue here that there is a reason, namely the statute's different, and that the only way to rid the workplace of, quote, any discrimination based on age is to apply the burden-shifting requirement. That's their argument. And why isn't that right, given Gross?
Well, again, I think if you look at any discrimination, free from any discrimination, and the statute stopped there, we might be where plaintiff needs to be. But the statute doesn't. It says based on age. And
Of course it is, because it's an age discrimination statute. Of course it's based on age. And it's different from, in other words, it describes a type of discrimination. Unlike 623, it doesn't modify the action. It's not because of, it's describing the type of discrimination that's barred. So it's a very different statute. And here, I mean, I'll just tell you exactly my concern about the government's position here, all right? Let's assume for a minute, let's you and me not argue about what the district court finding means. I understand your ultimate position is it's not sufficient to shift the burden, but suppose what the district court found here was that age was a factor, not the because of factor. The plaintiff is, once we're at this stage, right, we're at the point where the plaintiff has failed to show it's the but-for factor, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so, but the district court has found that it is a factor, right?
Yes.
In the decision. So, given that, unless you shift the burden at that point, then we can't say, as Congress has directed, that the decision in this case was free from any discrimination based on age. That's my problem with your argument. So what's the answer to that?
Well, I think,
in other words, how can we fulfill Congress's direction here? Now, you know, Congress applied a very sweeping law to the government, not to the private sector. this only applies to the public, but Congress used very different language. So it obviously meant this was to be quite sweeping. And how do we fulfill that objective if we leave in place a decision finding that although age was not the but-for factor, it was a factor? See my point?
I do.
Okay.
I think that essentially, if you look at it as, and this is Gomez-Potter now, Gomez-Potter comes along and says, you can read free from any discrimination as including retaliation claims. That's a cause of action. What Gross says, though, is that
Gomez was dealing with a different issue than we have.
Agreed. But they still read
Gomez
the free from any
different question. Gomez didn't tell us anything about it. It didn't say that the language of 633A was no longer was to be read anyway other than its plain language.
Isn't saying though that it's a factor the same as saying it's a mixed motive case,
exactly,
essentially? And what the what Gross makes clear is because Title VII has that mixed motive language in the statute, whereas 633A does not.
But Gross tells us you're totally right about 623, but Gross says very clearly we are to start with the language of the statute, and the language of the statute here. I mean, Gross drives us to look at 633, not 623, and you're totally right about Title VII. Title VII has nothing to do with this. Government's right about that. But it's 633A. The language is different. And I'm telling you, I don't see how this court can faithfully apply the language Congress adopted in 633A without allowing a burden shifting at this point. And that's what you have to respond to that for me.
I think if you're saying that age is a factor, it's as if you're saying age is one of many motives.
Exactly.
Right? So in other words, you're getting to a mixed motive type
exactly.
case.
Exactly.
Well, Gross, now I understand Gross talks about 623A, but their logic was 623A, unlike Title VII.
You're missing the point. I agree with you about Title VII. Title VII has nothing to do with this case. I totally agree with that. But Gross says, you agree with me that Gross says we look at the language of the statute, right?
Yes.
Okay. So they look at 623, and the court says, okay, we begin with the ordinary default rule, right? The plaintiffs bear the risk of failing to prove, that is, that the burden of proof remains with the plaintiff, right? Okay. And then it says, you know, absent statutory, you know, without the statute changing the burden of proof, which is what Title VII did, right? But 623 didn't. The court says the burden of proof remains with the plaintiff. And then it says this. We have no warrant to depart from the general rule in this setting, right?
Yes.
So the court is saying that if there were a compelling reason to depart from the general rule, it would. But there wasn't in this case because of the way 623 is written. So what the parties are arguing here, relying entirely on Gross, is that here there is a compelling reason to depart from the general rule, namely the broader language of 633. And you can't answer that question for me by going back to Title VII. Because this is totally independent of Title VII.
Let me try it this way.
You see my point?
You're right. If you want to look at 633A, you have to look at what's in the statute, correct?
Well, I'm doing what Gross told us to do.
Right, but Gross also tells you you have to look at what's not in the statute. And what's not in the statute is mixed motive language, which Title VII has.
Omission is
the key.
It says, quote, after looking at that, why would it say we have no warrant to depart from that rule? If it wasn't okay to depart from the rule under certain circumstances?
What rule?
The default rule, that the burden of proof remains with the plaintiff. You see my point? I'll try once more, okay? As I read Gross is saying, Gross starts out and says, number one, forget Title VII, right? And I'm completely with you on that. Title VII has nothing to do with this because Congress, when it amended Title VII and amended Title VII, it didn't amend 623, okay? So Gross says, all right, we look at the language of the statute. The default rule is that if there isn't any burden shifting in the statute, burden remains with the plaintiff, and, quote, we don't see any reason to depart from that. Now, the Supreme Court doesn't stick language in its opinions. It doesn't have meaning. And so it said here, we didn't see a reason to depart from it. And what the plaintiff is arguing here is that there is a reason in this case, namely the different language of the statute, which is exactly what Gross tells us to look at. And their argument is that we can't be faithful to the language of Congress here unless we are able to deal with a case where the district court has found that race, though not the but-for factor, I'm sorry, age, though not the but-for factor, is a factor. Okay? So,
you know, I guess I disagree that Title VII is irrelevant. It was raised in Gross to show that while Title VII allows for a mixed mode of analysis, 623A does not. 633A also lacks that language. There's nothing in there that allows for a mixed motive analysis.
The argument makes is that there is language in 633A when it says free from any discrimination. That is language which would permit.
Based on age, and Gross makes clear that because of is the same thing as based on.
Modifies a different word.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
It modifies a different part of the statute. In 633, the based on modifies the type of discrimination.
Yeah.
In 623, it modifies the employment action. The sentence is, have you ever diagrammed a sentence?
Yes.
Okay. If you diagram these sentences, you'll see that they modify different clauses.
Yeah.
Agreed.
This is where that stuff you learn in the sixth grade actually really helps.
Let me suggest to you that even if you're right, this isn't the right case for this because
okay,
there are
let's
many
get on
other
that.
Reasons why.
Let's get on to that, okay?
Sure.
All right, let's assume that the plaintiffs are right that mixed motive analysis does apply here, okay?
Okay.
All right. Here's what the district court says. And let's assume also that you're right that the plaintiff has failed to show that age was the but-for reason for it, okay?
Yes.
Right. Otherwise, the plaintiff would have won on the McDonnell-Douglas analysis, right? Okay. So here's what the district court says. He says a couple things. It's clear to me that, bottom line, that age in some way, in some respect, had to have been a factor here. Why isn't that saying exactly what Pricewaterhouse said, that you shift the burden when the prohibited factor plays a role? In other words, it's one of the factors.
Well,
that's a district court finding I just read you.
True. But again, you have to look at based on, and they say based on means because of.
Why don't you assume you're wrong about that, too, for purposes of my hypothetical, okay?
Okay.
Because we're not going to get anywhere unless. And it's a hypothetical. I understand your argument about the statute's language. You're free to make it. For purposes of hypothetical, you're not waiving that argument, okay?
Okay.
Assume you're wrong. Why isn't this language from the district court? It's clear to me that, bottom line, that age in some way, in some respects, had to have been a factor here.
Let's assume it was. I think they found a lot of other reasons why we made the decision that we made that would have.
No, but the district court never shifted the burden, did it?
I guess I'm saying if it had, it still would have concluded that.
Oh, but we can't. Oh, really?
That's my contention. Yes.
Okay, but if you're right, you would accept. I mean, if I'm right that this is a finding, you would acknowledge that one appropriate remedy would be for us to remand it for the district court to now do that analysis, correct? I realize the plaintiff says you didn't raise it below, I think that's silly. I think this is an open question, and if we think that Pricewaterhouse applies and that there's enough evidence here to shift it, the government should have a chance to prove that you would have hired the other guy anyway, right?
In light of the district court's finding that there was no evidence that age...
He said there was no evidence that age was the dispositive factor. That's your McDonnell-Douglas analysis. It has nothing to do with price.
Given your hypothetical, could it be remanded?
Yeah.
In a given case, yes.
I'm talking about this case.
I just don't think it's appropriate given the findings of the district court, wherein he said there's a lot of other reasons here, including the recommendation, the fact that they were looking for programmatic, budgetary, and technical expertise that the plaintiff in this case didn't show he had, whereas the selectee did.
How can we do that? I mean, whether or not the government is able to meet its burden of showing that that the Navy would have hired the other guy anyway. That's a fact question. I mean, that requires findings. We can't make them here. The district court didn't make a finding on that. We're reviewing. He never got to it.
You know, for all practical purposes.
We don't do that thing here. You heard the last case. It's not what we do here. Right?
True. For all practical purposes, I think that when you put on a trial, you do put on all of your best evidence. You put on the reasons why you made the selection decision.
The government did not argue in the district court anywhere that even if there is evidence of discrimination based on age, it would have made the same decision anyway.
I don't think the evidence would have been any different.
No, but you didn't make that argument.
We didn't need to. I mean, that's not an argument that a defense defendant
has to make. Well, what do you think about the plaintiff's argument that since you didn't make it, if we think, A, that the Pricewaterhouse analysis applies, and, D, the district court finding was sufficient to shift the burden, that ends the case? There's no reason to remand because you didn't make the argument. What do you think about that?
Again, I don't think we have to make the argument. I think the evidence that we put on, for all practical purposes, would be the exact same evidence.
You've heard of waiver?
Yes.
Forfeiture?
Yes.
That's their argument. Their argument is you forfeited the argument by not making it.
You know, a mixed motive claim is something that a plaintiff raises. It's not a defense. I actually think the district court was incorrect by saying it's an affirmative defense. That is something that a plaintiff raises. They can plead in the alternative and say this was either the factor or, you know, part of a mixed motive defense. Their remedies are, you know, different depending on what the court finds. But would it change the defendant's case at all? No, we're going to put on our best evidence as to why we made this decision.
You'd say it's not an affirmative defense under either test.
Correct. Yes,
okay.
All right. I think I'm done.
Okay, I think. Yeah. See no further questions, and once again, we've talked to you way past your time, too. Thank you, counsel. We'll give the appellant back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I feel like I'll be rebutting Judge Tatel, so keep it brief.
I'm sorry, what?
I said I feel like I would be rebutting Judge Tatel. You actually did a lot of that argument, but I really don't have.
I don't think you want to rebut him. No, I don't.
I was being facetious.
I'm an amicus, if anything.
I'm only one of three people up here.
You really can't depend upon us to do what we look like we're going to.
I understand that.
We fool lots.
I don't have much to add except on this affirmative defense. I do believe that this was an issue that was waived.
Yeah, but why would we consider this waived? I mean, this is an open question. Even if you're right, and even if you convince us that you're right, this would be the first time this court's held that Pricewaterhouse applies. Why would you apply a technical forfeiture rule here? Wouldn't the fair thing be to remand it and have the district court make the appropriate findings?
Well, I think the reason I would argue for it being waived is because Judge Robertson actually did bring it up in his comments.
I'm not sure it's an affirmative defense anyway. You still have your case to prove that mixed motive analysis, as the government suggests, is something that the plaintiff would seem responsible for rather than the government. You have your case to prove. You start out with the burden. And what exactly is the affirmative defense here?
Well, we show that, according to Judge Robertson, we show that age was a factor and affected the process. The affirmative defense would have been Navy would have done the same thing anyway.
But that's not an affirmative defense, is it? Isn't that just a method of disproving the plaintiff's case rather than It's not a conflation and avoidance type. It's not saying, well, we did discriminate against him on the basis of race. It's saying we did not make this decision in a discriminatory fashion, an unlawful fashion.
Well,
I'm not sure it's correct to say that's an affirmative defense. And if it's not, then it can't be waived.
Well, I think Judge Robertson looked at that part of their case and found that they hadn't raised that. Okay. They hadn't made that argument.
But that's my point. Why would you have to explain to me why in a case like this we would do that to one of the parties? Mm-hmm. I mean, waiver's not, forfeiture isn't something that's absolute. And, the bottom line is we want our decisions to be just and fair. And in a case like this where you've got an issue of first impression and there's a lot of uncertainty in the proceedings below about what all this means, give me a good reason for not, assuming you're right, and, you know, I don't know, you know, assuming we agree with you about Pricewaterhouse, why, give me a good reason for, other than to say they didn't raise it, for not giving the government a chance to show it would have made the same decision anyway.
The only thing I would say in addition to what I've said is this was a bench trial. So unlike a jury trial, as in Gross, where there's confusion about the burdens of proof, this was a bench trial where Judge Robertson sat as the finder of fact.
Yeah, so what?
He was able to evaluate everything. He knew the law, and he did comment on the affirmative.
But you just told us that he applied the wrong legal standard. Your whole argument is that the district court applied a much harsher legal standard than he should have. Isn't that your argument?
But the only thing I would say is that he did observe that there is this affirmative defense and that he didn't see anything in what the government presented that would rebut Mr. Ford's evidence.
That's
that
not
was
the way I read his decision. I read his decision as saying there's no reason to shift the burden here. You haven't shown enough. It's not substantial.
Well, from the bench, he said the affirmative defense would have been a more credible defense. So that is why I think he considered that, and he thought it would be a more credible defense, but he rejected it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We've talked you past your time again, and the case will be submitted.